Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Megapastor Joel Osteen has built a small empire from the sales of his best-selling books, his televangelism, and one of the largest congregations in the country. Now, through highly interactive Facebook and Twitter strategies, he may be changing the interface of Christianity. Here to discuss his church's social media strategy is executive tech blogger for the Huffington Post, Bianca Bosker, who wrote about Osteen's operation recently. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your article in the Huffington Post is about a recent event called the Night of Hope, which took place at Marlins Park Stadium in Miami, and it was packed. Can you describe the scene and what everyone was doing there?
Absolutely. So Joel Osteen is, he has the biggest church in the United States. It's actually in Houston, Texas. Not surprisingly, everything's bigger in Texas, which is a converted Houston Rockets stadium. And they take this, so the sermons on the road every month or so. And once a year, they hold these major sermons in the stadium. And so that's what was going on in Miami. And you had some 36,000 people flooding into that stadium to hear him talk and hear him preach. But really, I think the main event was taking place online. You had 138,000 people tuning in to actually watch a live stream of his sermon taking place there. And in addition to, you know, they weren't just watching a video of it. You actually had a very elaborate operation taking place where people had been hired to interact with the people tuning in online. So I basically went to Miami for this Night of Hope to see how this big operation was going from televangelism to digivangelism and really interacting with people online.
I like that. It kind of rolls off the tongue. Digivangelism.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't, apparently.
Well, they had, it was impressive, right? Because they had, you know, in addition to the whole team of people there, the choir, the people are really there to be present at the stadium. They had 10 people hired just to manage the social media accounts, another 11 that Joel Osteen Ministries had in-house to make sure everything went smoothly, and then 7 prayer partners remotely on call to answer people's prayers. So this is a big social, you know, soul-saving social media operation.
What do you mean by prayer partners there to answer people's prayers, or was it to get their requests, or how did that work?
Exactly. So one of the interesting things that Joel Osteen Ministries is doing, and some other churches are as well, is really taking prayer online. So in addition to replying to prayers on Facebook, on Twitter, and on the live chat they had going during the Night of Hope, they encourage people to actually email in their prayers or phone them into the prayer line. And there are these people who are both Lakewood Church, that's Joel Osteen's church, they're staff members and volunteers who are on hand to pray with people via email, via phone, via Facebook. And they will, in some cases, send along scripture, in some cases, type out a prayer for someone. In addition to that, because the volume of prayers that they receive online is so high, Joel Osteen Ministries is actually set up what they describe as a kind of Reddit-like prayer platform, which crowdsources prayers. So if you go onto their site, people can post their prayers, and other members of the congregation can reply. And literally, it's click pray to pray. You can add a note to someone, but you can also just tick a button that says, I'm praying for you.
My guest is Bianca Bosker. She's executive tech editor for Huffington Post. We're talking about digivangelism, where I guess technology meets the pulpit. If you have a question or comment for Bianca, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We just hit 4,000 fans on our Facebook page over the weekend. Bianca, how many am I close to Joel Osteen yet?
Oh, you're not even in the same league. I'm sorry to tell you. So what's really fascinating about Joel Osteen, and this applies to many of the other mega pastors as well, is they have a great number of fans, but you know, maybe a fraction of the number that a Rihanna or Justin Bieber gets. But their fans are dedicated on a level that I've never seen. I mean, if you look at Rihanna, who's the most followed human on Facebook, I think she has like 70 million fans. Joel Osteen has 3 million or so. A post that Rihanna will put up on Facebook may get 40,000 interactions on average. Joel Osteen gets 160,000 on average. That's people liking it, commenting on it, sharing it. If you look at Whole Foods, for example, the brand on Twitter, you know, they have, I think, twice as many followers as Joel Osteen. They'll be lucky if they get 12 retweets. Joel Osteen gets maybe 3,000, 5,000 on average. People are really committed to spreading his message. In fact, many of the Christian evangelicals I spoke with saw Facebook and Twitter as a new way of really spreading the word. Not only was it a way for them to get a little bit of daily inspiration in their lives, but it was a way for them to actually spread the Lord's message to non-believers that might follow them on those social media sites. I actually spoke with a woman who said that Facebook had been really pivotal in helping her to find her faith. She'd been seeing all of these posts from friends of hers who were religious, and it really inspired her to get involved with a local evangelical church, and actually her husband was baptized recently.
Now, that night, not everything went absolutely smoothly. Some people were getting error messages in response to their prayer requests. What happened?
Yeah, so one of the things that, so these 10 people that were set up to help moderate this chat room, again, tens of thousands of people in this chat room, sometimes saying that they were watching, how much they were enjoying it, other times really letting loose and kind of opening up about the terrible things going on in their lives, from domestic abuse to brain cancer. And people would, the moderators that were hired for the night would respond in some cases by saying, you know, you can email your prayers to our prayer partners. Here's the web address. Here's the email address. Unfortunately, the email address they were giving out was the wrong one. So there were a slew of people who got a message saying that their, you know, the automatic Gmail response that they would get said that the delivery of their prayer had, quote unquote, failed permanently. And so it just struck me as this incredible, you know, strange period that we found ourselves in where suddenly prayers aren't going through. And it creates a strange kind of question and a dilemma, right? I mean, how do we grapple with that in the digital age? What happens when people post a sort of need on something on such a personal level and they get undermined in that way? So people were frustrated by it, but luckily they solved it relatively quickly.
How does Joel Osteen actually come in contact with any of these prayers that are emailed in or put in there via Facebook or tweeted? How much contact does he come in to those?
That's a great question. So he helps kind of determine the voice of the site. He's actually much more engaged with Twitter than he is on Facebook. So he follows, he has a kind of secret separate account that he set up from which he follows his main feed. And he does keep a close eye on it. And his PR team said that they'll definitely get a call from him if something that goes out is not in his voice. But he's not, you know, actively hitting the tweet button himself. And in fact, whereas some other pastors have been sharing more personal things about what they're up to, what they're doing that weekend, he's really tried to maintain a very simple, consistent voice. And the tweets that he sends out are these short snippets of inspiration taken directly from his books, his sermons, and his blogs. But he does, you know, he has designated this large group of people to really act as an intermediary for him. And people do still feel like they're getting contact with him, even if it's not coming from him directly. So, you know, part of this big team, if someone does post a prayer request, they really make an effort to respond to every Facebook post that they can. But they will note that it comes from, they sign it off with JOM team, which stands for Joel Osteen Ministries team, just to signal that it's not coming directly from the man himself.
Was internet security an issue at all? Did anybody think, particularly people who were pouring, you know, spilling their guts, worried that their employers or their family would see their tweets?
At some point, it has been. Absolutely. It's a real concern. So in the Night of Hope chat room, people did have the option of using a screen name. But I found, because I followed up with many of the people afterwards, that they had been using their real names. And it's fascinating because I think so often on social networking sites, people share really the best of their lives. And oftentimes it's a fictional version of it, but still it's the skinny vacation photos. Mm-hmm. It's the promotions. And I was so struck by the fact that here was a site where people were really opening themselves up, and they were sharing the really ugly, dark, terrifying things that they were confronting in their lives. But they have faced issues. So Joel Osteen Ministries did tell me that in the past they've integrated with Facebook, and they ran into an issue where as people were commenting in their chat rooms, those comments were simultaneously showing up on their personal Facebook pages. Now, that's a huge privacy issue if you think about people who might be taking to these chat rooms to comment about struggles they're having in their lives. Again, mm-hmm. domestic abuse that they're facing at home, frustrations with a friend that maybe won't come around. So they've instead decided to go ahead and build their own platform to try and solve some of those privacy issues.
When you were at the event at the stadium, how was it packed? I mean, how did it parallel what was going on digitally?
So it was definitely not totally packed, although completely sold out. I'd heard that there were a few infrastructure issues getting some people there, but certainly a large, large crowd of people. It's a really striking experience, the way that these people just come together and the songs, and it's very moving. You know, it's interesting because this practice of digivangelism isn't something that's completely accepted in the community.
Okay.
There are preachers and megapastors who rail against these quote-unquote flat-screen preachers who think that those experiences are a pale shadow and that they take away from the real power of bringing people together in person. But I was struck by how moved people were. I spoke with a woman who joined the chat room. She was a woman named Janice, and she had come to ask for prayer and support because she felt like she and her husband were growing apart. And she's actually involved with a local church. She teaches Sunday school, and she tries to go to Bible studies there. But what she told me was that it's actually quite difficult for her to make those. She's raising three young children. And because she's a grandmother raising her grandchildren, there's either these prayer groups for younger parents or prayer groups for older individuals, and neither one does she really fit into. So she's really found real solace in a virtual setting. She's turned to places like the Night of Hope chat rooms or to prayer.com or to Joel Osteen's Facebook page as a way of connecting with people around the world. And for her, it wasn't a pale shadow of the real thing. It was real comfort that she needed from real people.
Do people sort of follow these Night of Hope, whatever it's called.
Night of Hope, yeah.
Do they kind of follow them online like, you know, the Deadheads used to follow the Grateful Dead? I mean, do they, like, send in prayers every time they're out and about like that?
Yeah, well, so absolutely. I mean, there's Joel Osteen Ministries goes to every measure to make sure that they're broadcasting their message. So not only do they have 10 million people tuning in on television every week, but every sermon that they have is actually posted. You can stream it online from their website. You can watch it later on YouTube. You can download the podcast. So the Night of Hope is really these sort of chat rooms and these live viewing experiences are a really kind of unique, special experience to take part in real time.
Mm-hmm.
But really, they make it possible to consume his message in any format someone pleases. So and that's a really popular mechanism as well. People are absolutely tuning on YouTube and podcasts and stuff.
You said there's critics. Are there others out there that are trying to emulate it?
Absolutely. I think you've seen churches really embracing technology in a fascinating way. Another one I came across in my research, another evangelical Christian church called Life Church. And they've actually been doing some even more daring things with technology. I almost think about Joel Osteen Ministries as the kind of Apple of the evangelical Christian world and Life Church as the Google. Joel Osteen really focuses high production value, high touch experience. On the other hand, Life Church is really developing a ton of tools from apps to even kind of metric measuring things and software that churches can use to see how people are following them online and off. So they do fascinating things. They've really helped pioneer this idea of the multi-site church, and they have even an internet campus. So they have really made it possible for people to log in online to join in with these services and communities. And that they really, I think, we're seeing that this the road to Damascus is a hyperlink, and places like Life Church and Joel Osteen Ministries are making that a reality.
Well, Bianca Bosker, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it. It's pretty interesting.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Bianca Bosker is executive tech editor for Huffington Post. When we return, we're going to learn, get some more ideas for apps for children. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org.
Fake meat conjures up images of tofu burgers or veggie bacon, right? Us, we're talking actual edible test tube meat made in a lab.
There's a whole range of technical, social, economic issues that need to be thought through.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, lab-grown meat. Would you eat it? The story next time on Marketplace from APM.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 89.7 NPR News is your all-day NPR news station, bringing you news and information 7 days a week and always streaming at WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Kids love gadgets, and there are a ton of fun and educational apps for kids. There are so many, in fact, that it can be hard to know which apps and games to download. Joining us now to sift through the options and share some of his recent favorites is a veteran kindergarten teacher who also reviews apps for children. Chris Crowell is the associate editor of the Children's Technology Review, and he joins us today from California, where you're at an app developer conference. Welcome back, Chris.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Ann. It's great to be here.
So I'm going to ask our listeners to call in if they have a favorite app for the kid in their life. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org and share that app. We've got about five to go through today. One is Kindoma Storytime.
Yes, Kindoma's Storytime is a newer app. We became aware of it. It's just been released, I believe it was in February, at the Bologna Book Awards in Bologna, Italy. It's a publisher out here in California, and Kindoma, Kin is for family, and Doma, Oma, is the grandmother name in German. And the publisher who created this, it's a children's ebook where you can share the book with somebody from far away. So as long as both ends of the Wi-Fi or ends of the story going into the app are on Wi-Fi, a grandparent can read a story to their grandchild from across the country to across the world, really. And it's one that Warren Buckleitner and I, my senior editor, we demonstrated in Utah in March. I was in New Jersey, he was in Utah, and it's really a fabulous app. You can see who's ever turning the page. You can see the finger, so the child on the other end is actually seeing the whole interaction with the book. And at the same time, you're both using the camera on the apps or on the iPad to be able to see the person reading to you. So it's great for grandparents to read to their grandchildren. It's great for parents who might be traveling on business and the child's at home. They would still want to read a bedtime story with them. There's a pretty good collection of stories already on the app, and it's a free app at this point to install, and you can buy more books. And that's their big thing, is talking this weekend out here to the developers, is acquiring more titles to put into the app.
So you have to buy the books for the app.
They have some books that are free, mm-hmm. And then other ones, as they start to get more and more, they'll have to charge a small amount. I think they said anywhere from $1.99 to maybe $4.99 for a title.
Can you reuse it?
Oh yes, you can reuse it. You can reuse the stories that are in your library. Like I said, there's about 20 to 30 that come for free.
Mm, okay.
So it's really a neat one, and that's what we're talking this week. I had some discussions with them about how we can use that within the schools as well, because it's targeted for children between the age of 2 and 8. So we're hitting the preschool and then kindergarten, first and second grade. There may be a way where you can read along with the child from across the room or from, from room to room or from school to school to share a story, which is a big part of language acquisition and reading development for young children.
I was thinking it'd be great for kids who are stuck at home sick.
That's true. That as well. Yep. So they could still take part in the guided reading lessons or the that are in the classroom, or if there's even a shared reading, the whole group, if you had that set up, the teacher could have the child come in to hear the story.
What do you mean when you say you can see the fingers turning the page? Who gets to turn the page?
Actually, it can be either one. On either end, there's a little red shadow that goes across the book. You can actually, of the hand, a shadow of the hand. So you would see, the finger being put on the corner of the page and the page actually being turned and the hand moving across. So on both ends, you can see the user's shadow of their hand onto the page. So the child could highlight, oh, what was that word? And they could be pointing to a word in the book. So that's one of the things that really makes it amazing, is because it has the whole experience of turning the page, seeing the hand. Not only do you have the interaction on the camera, but you also have the kind of the tactile interaction that both users can see. Okay, somebody's going to turn the page because I can see the shadow of their hand.
Okay. Is it just for tablets or smartphones too?
Right now it's just for tablets. It's just for the iPad. It's the only platform.
Dr. Panda's Supermarket. Kids love to run their, toy stores and that kind of a thing. Is this that sort of version but digital?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And this one, this is one that in my classroom, it goes to show you that, sometimes reviewers, we look at them and we say, okay, well, what's the substance, what they're going to get out of it? And there's a lot of neat little things in it and good educational games, but it was in my classroom. My students, they absolutely love it. It's one of the apps that they go back to a lot. And I've seen them take it home to their parents, and the parents have come up to me and commented about it in a very positive nature, that the younger siblings at home as well enjoy playing it on their iPhones or iTouches as well. So,
what kind of decisions are they making?
They have to sort. They're looking at, there's one part where there's a recycling machine, and they have to figure out where to put the trash out of three different options. So they're learning how to sort and classify. They're collecting things in their cart. They have to figure out a way to collect all the shopping carts. So it's like a little pattern of sequencing. So there's lots of small things that the kids really can have some good educational concepts reinforced and even learned. But the big thing is they also, along with that learning, they love and go back to it all the time. And that's one of the other things we've talked about this weekend here at App Camp, is making children want to go back and have fun as well as learning and remembering that it's the child had a good experience. So this was one that the kids proved to me that this is really a strong app for them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and my guest right now, Chris Crowell, contributing editor for Children's Technology Review. Chris is a veteran kindergarten teacher. He also reviews apps for children. He's at an app developer conference in California right now. If you have a question or comment, if you want to suggest an app for the rest of us, if you have a particular favorite, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Seven little words for kids. I read about this, and I wasn't sure if the description worked with my way my brain works. Can you tell us about that?
Okay. Seven little words for kids is actually adopted from the older version of seven little words, just the seven little word puzzle, which is an app that is targeted to adults or to... Really, it was brought to my attention by my nephew, when he was studying for the SAT. So seven little words was kind of helped him to understand, get definitions, and figure out a little bit how to chunk together words and figure out their meaning based upon clues. And so it was such a popular game, and actually my mother loves that game as well.
Check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. My mother, who's retired, she's seven little words is one she plays every single day. But the developer, Christopher York, created Seven Little Words for Kids because I think he got a lot of feedback from teachers saying that, you know, this is great for us, but there is kids from about second grade on who could really benefit from learning the words. It's broken down into sounds. It's very much the phonics where you can, and you have to place them together based upon the clue that it's given. You don't hear any sound, so that's the one thing. There's no speech to it. It's all just a visual and interaction, so it doesn't say anything back to you. But by second, third, fourth, and fifth and sixth grade, which is most of what this is targeted to, that's all right. They don't need to hear the sounds back. They've already acquired the sounds. They're just looking at breaking down the words and parts to kind of help them with their spelling and expand their vocabulary.
Then there is Little Red Riding Hood.
Yes, and this is an ebook, and this is by a developer, a publisher over in London, Nosy Crow, and they've had a series of really excellent graphic fairy tale stories, and this is the latest one in their series, Little Red Riding Hood. There's a lot of interaction. There's little speech bubbles that pop up each time the character is pushed or touched, and they have their own little dialogue that goes with it as the story follows along. And then there's some other nice, very nice little touches where as the Little Red Riding Hood is walking along the path, there's a little pond next to the path, and she stops to look in it. And when she looks in it, the reflection is actually the user using the camera on the iPad and the iPhone and the iPod Touch, if you have the latest generation. It puts the user's, the child's picture reflection into the water, so they're into the story as well. And the other thing too is they have lots of great voices, and they pay attention to the language and how it's presented. They use professional child actors and actresses to voice the stories. So it's just a very high quality app.
The quality of the visuals and stuff must be getting pretty amazing at this point.
They are. Yes, they really are, and that's one of the things that I've talked about being in the classroom and seeing how the apps have come through over the past couple of years is that the apps that we thought were highly rated and really acclaimed a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. Now you can see the level of the newer apps coming out, just making it so much higher. So the new apps that are developed are, you know, the graphics are fabulous. The child interaction is very, very rich and very supportive of child development. So we're really seeing a big jump in the quality overall in the past year.
Do kids tend to get stuck on one app, one or two apps, or are they really open to trying new things all the time? I mean, do they know where that app thing is on their parents' smartphone or on the pad?
Yeah, do they know where the apps were? We had a kids panel yesterday, and we asked that question, and the kids know where the app store is. They have made changes where so now children can't just go and make purchases without parent approval. You have the passwords. The big concern is some apps that put in-app sales, where a child could be in the middle of something and wants to continue on, and they have to pay to get either a larger version or something else into it. And that's an ethical issue that I think we're having a discussion on. Everybody who's involved in the app development industry is that, are you having children? Is that not good for the children? Is that an ethical way to increase your sales or to increase revenue at the kind of tricking kids into purchasing? But going back to your, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, but going back to your original, the kids do. I've seen the children really do like to experiment and find other apps. They do have some that they always go back to, kind of as a fallback.
Mm-hmm.
But they really do. They're curious and they're interested in what is new and what comes out. And at the same time, I've seen in my classroom and in my school that the kids have become much more critical as well. They'll try an app, but they'll quickly hit the home button and move on to another one if it doesn't grab them right from the beginning and offer a strong, rich experience for them.
What about ads? Are they exposed to ads in these things?
Some are exposed to ads. The ones that we kind of stay away, and a lot of times we give a lower review if there's in-app ads. And we don't. And there has been a trend that is kind of troubling, where also they have little Facebook icons or Twitter icons to share what the kids are doing within the app. We don't like that, and we don't think that, that's the right place for that to be put. The ads are not. Most of the high quality ones do not have ads in them.
How do they get their revenue? How does that work?
They have to look for the number of downloads. They have to really get people to go in and download and buy the app up front. And that's why the free app is not really something. The better developers and the bigger developer companies, they can offer like 1 day free apps. Just to drive people to that particular app that's there, but then also hopefully have them go, okay, we like this developer. Let's see what else they have. What else can be recommended based upon your experience with that one good app. So that's we have that discussion. The app developers, they spend a lot of time and they do invest a lot of money to create these apps, and offering them for free is obviously kind of a big hit for them, and they don't want to advertise within the apps. They do think that that's not the most ethical thing to do, but they also want to be able to make a living and survive.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a balance of some way. And that's why I think we've also seen a lot of apps. Originally, when it came out, the apps were priced just like you would have the iTunes with the music, were 99 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And then the app developers realized that, 99 cents for each download is not going to get very far. So they're starting to raise their prices up a little bit to $1.99 or $2.99. Some of the ebooks are going to go a little bit higher, maybe $4 to $8.99, in that range. And then you have the older educational children, things that are targeted to them. We've seen apps now getting up to $14.99 and such, but those are, you really have to check to see what the quality is and see what the story is. And you want to pay that amount of money if you know that you're going to learn something that you wouldn't be exposed to any other way. So, and there's some very good ones. I did one app, Shakespeare Sonnet, that is geared towards high school students that is absolutely fabulous. And that was $14.99, but they had professional actors and actresses from England reading all of Shakespeare's sonnets, and it really gave a great experience. And it was one that when I opened it up, I said, oh gosh, I wish I had this when I was in high school and college.
Right.
Because now I understand the sonnets, and I understand some of the language of Shakespeare just through that app. And so there are some good ones that can be expensive, but a lot of them that are really worth it.
I could have used that for Chaucer.
Yes.
Chris Crowell, thanks so much for joining us again. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I enjoy coming on.
Chris Crowell, he's contributing editor for Children's Technology Review. He's also a veteran kindergarten teacher. He gets set free sometime in June. Right now, he's at a he's at a conference today for app developers in California. Stay tuned. We'll return with more with Tech Tuesday with Russell Holly from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
That's Michael Douglas as Liberace in the new HBO movie Behind the Candelabra. Matt Damon plays his young boyfriend. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Steven Soderbergh about directing the movie. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
This is my quest to follow that star.
Support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, New Yorker writer George Packer's inside history of the great unwinding of America's 20th century way of life and where we stand now. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Examine the 68-year history of nuclear weapons. It's In My Lifetime, Wednesday night at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, Google held its annual developers conference and made a slew of announcements about upcoming changes to Google services and Android devices. Joining us now to give us a breakdown of the major developments coming our way is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Google Wallet. We've talked about it before, but refresh our memory and tell us what's coming.
So previously, we've talked about Google Wallet as kind of a wireless payment system where you can take your phone and tap it to a register and pay for something. And Google's going to work on that, but that's kind of going to be a slow rollout thing over the next couple of years as people get used to it. The second part of Google Wallet is the ability to, use it as a payment system online. So when you're purchasing something on a website, you would use Google Wallet because all of your information would, in theory, already be stored within your Google account. And now they've made it so that you can use it almost like you would use PayPal to send money back and forth to friends or to people you're making small transactions with just via email.
Okay. All right. So that's interesting. It can be a personal thing. I was wondering if it is going to do any damage to PayPal.
I mean, it's certainly possible. There's, a whole lot of Google users out there, and it's something that Google's going to have to advertise that they have. Right now, the setup is incredibly quick and convenient. If you're already in Gmail, you open up a new message, and right next to the attach button, there's a dollar sign now. You press that, and you can send money to whoever you want. It's really frictionless, as opposed to services like Venmo or PayPal, where you have to log into PayPal, you have to get the information for the person you're sending to, mm-hmm. you have to describe whether or not you're sending it for goods or services so that they know how to charge either you or the person that's receiving the money. And it gets kind of complicated depending on what it is you're doing or how frequently you use it. Whereas, it looks like Google Wallet from my testing is a whole lot easier to use.
Is it free?
Absolutely.
Can you make payments to people who don't have a Google Wallet account?
Right now, it's Google Wallet to Google Wallet. They haven't said a whole lot about how they're going to change that. And Google Wallet is slowly rolling out to everyone with a Google account. So it's just something that is just starting to be available now. But, by the end of, say, next month, will be something that a lot of people will have access to.
Now, some people still won't use PayPal because they're worried about security issues. Is there any sense about what the security is on Google Wallet?
It would be the same security that you would have, sending an email message. You're not going to have to worry about it getting intercepted or anything like that. Google has been using, HTTP Secure for a while for all of their services. And it ends up being as secure as you are. If someone has access to your Google account, then someone has access to Google Wallet and your payment gateway. So it's as secure as your Gmail password, I guess.
My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment about something coming out of the annual developers conference at Google last week, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. All right, Google Maps, which is what I use exclusively. People like me, it's already the place to go for driving directions. How will that be changing?
Google Maps for your phone, your tablet, and the web browser is in the process of a pretty significant makeover. A lot of what you see in Google Maps right now, you've got these individual menus that are kind of split up across a bunch of their different services. And a lot of people have just been using it so long that they're used to that workflow. Mm-hmm. But it's really broken up when you think about all the different menus that are all over the place in Google Maps. They are currently testing a whole new menu service and a whole new layout that gives the screen more focus to the actual map itself and makes the individual menus, you know, all condensed into one thing that kind of floats wherever you need it so that you can drag it and move it around when you're looking for things. And really it's just it's visually, you know, very pretty, very fluid, incredibly fast, and ties in a lot of these existing services. So when you look up directions for, you know, from one place to another, if it's something that's just quick across town, then, you know, it'll give you directions for driving, but then you can very quickly switch over for walking directions or cycling directions or public transit. If you're making longer trips, it'll break out flights and give you quick look at, you know, average flight prices for those trips or train or anything like that. And it's all just, you know, built into what it is that you're doing.
Brian in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hey, thanks, Ann, and thanks, Russell. Actually, this doesn't have anything to do with the Google conference. Oh. I apologize. But I actually wanted to ask Russell if he saw anything about the new Ubuntu Linux tablets that would be coming out, if he's familiar with that, and if he has any comments on whether he likes it and whether he thinks it'll be ready anytime soon.
So I've actually used Ubuntu Touch on a couple of different devices now. I've used it on a Nexus 4 and a Nexus 7. And the initial results that I got, it's really pretty, but it's also really kind of slow. So it's something that they're definitely working on. I don't think that we'll see an actual release product until much closer to Christmas, if we will at all this year.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool. All right, Brian. Thanks a lot. Let's see, Google Maps. All right, so you'll be able to get inside. It says beyond seeing the street view, you'll be able to go inside some buildings.
So this is a project that Google's had for a little while now, where they've taken their street view service, where you can go, you know, onto the floor level, and their street view cars, where you can kind of pan around and see things. Well, they've given a bunch of different people backpacks, so that you can do things like you can take street view down into the Grand Canyon or even underwater in certain areas and inside some significant buildings as well. So like Grand Central Station or Sistine Chapel. These are all places where they've worked really hard to you know, give that third dimension where you can go inside the building and see things.
And is it good? I mean, is it well done?
It's the exact same experience that you get from the street view, kind of panning around and seeing things. It's that exact same interface, and you can explore a lot of really cool buildings. I would definitely suggest, you know, when it comes out, taking a look at things like Grand Central Station, you know, just because you can wander around for a really long time.
Uh-huh. Oh, that sounds cool. Now, Google Hangouts. Now is it simplifying several of its services or just pulling them all together under one umbrella?
It is, well, in theory, it's doing both.
Okay.
And really it's for people who use all of Google's kind of separate products. This was kind of jarring to see how it all came out. But so Hangouts is now the you know, single communication method for Google's services. If you're in Gmail, if you're on Google Talk, if you use the video chat Hangout services as a part of Google Plus, those are all now one service, and it works, you know, the same across all these things. The Google Talk client for the computer has been updated so that you can install either a Chrome extension or you know, something like that to you know, pull all of your messages in one place. The Google Talk app for Android and for the iPhone now pulls all of these services together. And it's really great if you are already using all of these products. If you're not, it's definitely going to take a little getting used to.
Is this some kind of competition for Skype?
Skype is definitely a target. Apple's iMessage is definitely a target. BlackBerry's unified messaging platform, BlackBerry Messenger, is definitely a target. And it's done really well. You know, this, Google's Hangout service has been the best video chat service for groups for at least a year now, you know, where you, for free, you can have up to 10 people in a room, and it's very, very fluid. It works very well. And so I would definitely say that, you know, Skype is one of the targets for this.
Russell, have we lost Russell? Are you there, Russell? Okay, we'll try Russell back. In the meantime, I guess I want to ask everybody, do you think that Google's going to take over the world? We'll get back to Russell. We still have time, so let's give him a call back.
In the meantime, you can bring your questions in, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about last week Google held its annual developers conference and made a bunch of announcements. We're talking about those with Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley, who, despite all the technology that we yak about every week, once in a while just drops out of nowhere, and I guess that's just the way we're headed. 614-292-8513, though, you know, it's always fun to see what Russell, you know, what he says to things. He'll talk about just about anything. Hi, Russell.
I love technology.
I was just saying, just so here we are talking about how great technology is, but gal darn it. One question in general, is Google going to take over the world?
I think that Google is going to have their own well-defined sandbox around the world. I don't know that they're going to own all of it, but they're certainly going to make it hard to not want to play in their sandbox.
We have a couple questions from listeners. Arlen sent a tweet for you. What kind of cool, useful hacks are being written for Glass? What kind of hacks, apps do you see coming for Glass?
So I actually just got Google Glass on Saturday, and there's a lot of new things. There's a lot to learn. You know, it's trying really hard to be this hands-free computer experience where, you know, you can take pictures and send tweets and respond to people who sent you emails and things like that, all without using your hands at all. And so it takes a lot of getting used to put yourself in that mindset where I can you know, be driving and actually use this without putting myself in danger or anything like that. It's really a useful thing. Some people have had it a little longer than me, and they've been developing and kind of playing and tweaking. And one of the things that has come from that is the ability to take pictures using something other than your voice. There's a sensor on the inside of Glass that allows you to wink, you know, kind of like force yourself to blink for an extended period of time, and that'll take a picture or a series of pictures if you need be. Whereas there's a couple people, you know, just kind of figuring out what this interface is all about.
I guess when you're describing the blinking thing, I just can't help but think of that Saturday Night Live spoof
exactly.
On it. Oh, my God. If anyone hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it just for fun.
Obviously, the Saturday Night Live one is poking fun, but there are a lot of things that fall into that video that are really true, and most of that is because people are still trying to figure out, you know, what exactly to do with this thing. And so it's going to be interesting for the next couple of weeks. There's really nothing terribly defined about it just yet.
All right, we got some go. Phil,
hello.
You're on the air, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on your question about Google's potential to sort of, be the leader in all of these spaces long term. And I think that they've been very smart about their strategy and are well positioned to sort of, I guess, eat everyone's lunch for them if they continue on that path. They've brought everything together in a really integrated way, and it works really well, not just for individuals, but for companies as well. And I think the long-term question will be, how long can they do this for free? And that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Phil. Yeah, and it seems like Google never rests. They're always working on it.
Well, I think that they're so big right now that they've got so many different teams working on so many different things that, you know, it feels to us like they're moving at this incredible breakneck pace when really it's you know, just a significant group of individual teams working on these projects.
Let's see. Jerry in Columbus, you have a question. Welcome.
Hi, Russell. I don't have a smartphone, but I do have a laptop, and I love my iGoogle page with all of my widgets.
Oh,
and
I'm so sorry.
Sick that they're taking it away. Can you help me out with that?
He just said he's sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I am too.
Yeah, iGoogle is something that, unfortunately, you know, it was a necessity in the days where, you know, MSN and Yahoo were the dominant forces, and they had that widget interface where all that stuff was there. But so few people use it anymore that it's one of those things. It's like Google Reader, you know, where it's not worth it for them to support it, so they're kind of sweeping it under the rug. There is an alternative, though. And it actually, I use it all the time. It works really, really well. It's kind of a homepage extension. If you use Google Chrome, then it's really useful. I will try really hard to get the name for it real quick. It basically, if you are in Chrome and you go to the Chrome Web Store and you look for the Google Now presentation, it takes that and applies it to your new tab page, so that when you open a new tab page, you have the search bar across the top and the news and weather and apps and all that stuff, and it's broken out very, very nicely. But the name escapes me right now.
All right, Jerry, thanks for that call. Real quick, Ken in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. I know time is limited. I just turned the program on, and I wasn't sure if Russell addressed Google two-step verification with regard to passwords, which I think is one of the most valuable things I've discovered in Google.
Two-factor authentication is an incredibly useful tool for anybody who decides to take advantage of it. It creates kind of a separate password in between you and your actual Google account that's constantly changing, you know, and is a really, really useful tool if you are kind of plugged in. I found that if I'm not using a smartphone and it does the thing where every time you go to sign in, it sends you a text message with the password, that becomes really tedious, in my opinion. But if you're using a smartphone, be it an iPhone or an Android phone, then it'll just, you know, put it as an app, and you open the two-factor app, and it ends up being pretty fun to use. But it's a significant way of securing all of your Google products.
All right, Ken, thanks a lot for that call. Rita posted a question on Facebook. Let's see if you can answer it in 60 seconds or less. On my cell phone, is there an app that would blink or something when I have received a text or phone call? I don't check my phone every other minute, so I need some help getting notified.
If you're on an Android phone, yes, there is an application. There's a notification application called NoTone, I think is N-O-T-O-N-E, I think is the name of the application. And what it does is it blinks a small colored pixel on your screen, as opposed to, you know, making a sound or anything like that when you have notification. And you can customize it to, you know, whatever color or size or anything you want to you know, offer that. But it is kind of battery intensive, so you're going to lose a little bit of battery life doing it.
And what about the iPhone? No?
There's not really an elegant way to do it on the iPhone unless you're jailbroken. And then that's not something that's particularly advised. The iPhone just, you know, their notification system is very much turn the screen on to see it.
Right. Well, it's just there as soon as you pick it up. It's not private.
Right.
Right. Anything else? We have about 30 seconds.
I just want to, I guess, continue on the conversation that we had before I hung up with Glass. That's something that I'll be probably mentioning once or twice here over the next couple of weeks as I try and figure out what exactly I'm going to do with it.
Okay. Why don't you send us some videos of you working on that?
I will do that. I will send you some videos of me working on Glass.
Because, you know, maybe they'll be as funny as Saturday Night Live. Who knows? Russell Holly, thanks a lot for joining us again today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening today. Thanks to the Allside staff as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Shannon Clary, and Leticia Wiggins. The video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.